Joining me again, it's Mark Jones here with the Ice Cream for the Soul Blog Talk Radio Show. And before I play the recording of the conversation I had with Molly, which was a conversation that really deeply impacted me, I've been thinking for a couple of days. I wanted to talk about the G word. It's something that's been coming up a lot lately in my conversations, and I'm talking about the word God. And it was funny because I was wondering whether I should mention this or not at the beginning of this show tonight. And then somebody on Facebook posted something on one of my pages, and a lady called Sarah, and she said, "I'm still learning not to react badly to the word God." And I think that's it's something I used to react badly to as well before I came across yoga many years ago and started reading things. I think it was just I'm from the UK, and we live in the UK. It's a largely irreligious society in the UK. And I think, unfortunately, that word God has been stained. I heard somebody once say it had been stained by so many dirty and bloody fingers, so, which is very unfortunate. So if you're in that kind of thinking, I would just ask you to put that aside, because I know from my perspective, a few years ago when I used to hear that word, I used to turn, if it was on TV or on a radio show, if I heard it, I would turn off. I'd just turn it off. I'd think, oh, this is just religious nonsense. But now, from my perspective, I'm seeing, if I use that word, God, I'm basically talking about the intelligence behind life. And when I talk about the intelligence behind life, I'm talking about, well, many people know I'm a gardener. And there's, for example, if I plant a daffodil bulb upside down, it will always grow the right way up. How does it know to do that? Some kind of intelligence, isn't there? And the same in the breath. When we breathe, we can scoff and say there is no intelligence behind life. But if you just try holding your breath and see how long it is before something boots you out of the way and you can't help but breathe, there's some kind of intelligence there. So basically, that I can't speak for my guests, but that's what I'm pointing to, and I think what many of my guests are pointing to when they mention that word. So if you are one of them people who get caught up on that word, which seems to be appearing more and more in my conversations, I'd just ask you to be open-minded. And it seems to me that though we can never understand this intelligence with the human intellect, we can learn how to flow with it. We can learn how to flow with this intelligence. And I think this is largely what the Ice Cream for the Soul conversations are about. So anyway, I'll shut up waffling and I'll continue and with the conversation with Molly. Thanks for bearing with me. Hi everybody, it's Mark Jones here again with the Ice Cream for the Soul Blog Talk Radio Show, and I'm very pleased to be speaking to Molly Gordon at last. I've been aware of Molly and Molly's work for the last few years really, in many ways, and people who know me know I spend quite a lot of time on messing about on Facebook, and I notice what people are posting and my Facebook friends, and in many ways that's a guide to whether or not I'm going to interview people or whether I ask people, because I think, oh yeah, I really like where they're coming from with that blog post or with that just little quote or whatever they're talking about. And Molly's been one of those people who I always resonate with what she's posted on Facebook. So anyway, without further ado, I'll bring Molly onto the air. How are you doing, Molly? Thank you for giving me your time today.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you, Mark. It's really exciting.
Lovely. It's lovely to be speaking to you. So would you just tell people a little, because I know some of my listeners will be aware of you and your great work, but would you mind just giving, just for those who don't know you, how would you mind giving a brief background of who you are and what you do and
sure.
all that stuff?
Sure. Well, for some reason, it occurs to me to start with my age. I'm going to be 62 on October 1st.
Oh, you're old codger then.
I'm an old codger. I'm kind
That's
of
young nowadays, isn't it? 60 is the new 40, they say.
It is, but yeah. I'm kind of excited about it. It's like, gee, and this will crack everybody up. Maybe I know something.
Yeah, maybe you do. Yeah, sorry, go on.
Anyway, so I've had a lot of different experiences in my life, of all sorts, personal and professional. And for the last 20 years, I have been a coach. And I was trained in a particular coaching tradition that's often represented throughout the world by the International Coach Federation. And it made sense, coaching made sense of everything and all the funny byroads that have been down in my life. And then about 5 years ago, I started to hear rumblings about the three principles. I had also trained as a certified facilitator, Byron Katie. I had a fiber arts studio. I'm a grandma. I'm married to an amazing guy. So lots of stuff has come into the mix, but there's always been a way in which I wanted to understand what the heck is going on. You know, what's going on with me? When I was a very little girl, I grew up Catholic, and as a very little girl, I felt really close to God, and I also felt really far away from God. And there was a way in which that just broke my heart. And so one way to talk about it, and I mean, it's all made up, but one way it occurs to me to talk about it is all my life, I've been looking for a way to get back to God. And I've taken some really wonky paths that might have looked like running in the opposite direction, as a matter of fact.
We'll dive into that as we get into the conversation.
Yeah. So anyway, I came across the three principles, and something, at first it just didn't seem like a big deal. I thought, okay, yeah, that's what it is. But what I saw actually was in my friend Michael Neal. I saw such changes in Michael that I thought, maybe there's something more here. And so I kept going back and looking again and looking again. And where I am at today, it occurs to me that I'll just keep going back and looking again and again and again. Because I'm really appreciating the difference between having an intellectual grasp of what's going on, of how life works, and having insight into it and how endless that insight process is. So I feel like I've babbled a lot and I have no idea what I said.
No, that was lovely. It's give people a feel for who you are and where you've come from. Mm-hmm. So the first question that immediately comes to mind for me, and sometimes are really off the wall questions that come into mind, and sometimes are quite relevant. So let's hope I have some relevant ones.
Okay.
Since you've got a grasp, whichever way you want to call it, of the three principles, how would you say your coaching has changed, if at all?
Wow. It's changed, it seems like, so many ways, so many times in just 5 years. At first, it was like, hey, guys, get this. This is so cool. And I would just kind of blab my limited understanding of how thought creates experience. And it was intriguing to me at the time. I was doing a lot of teaching about building businesses. And my clients and students just went, wow, that's really cool. And they made of it whatever they made of it. Fairly short conversations that took them a long way. And then I got to be a serious student of the principles. And it really messed up my coaching for a while.
I can relate.
I thought that I had a job to deliver the truth according to the three principles.
Right.
And that was tedious for everyone. The upside of that is it was so ineffective that I got over it pretty fast. But it really was tedious. And in a way, where I am now is almost back at where I started. You know, Mark Howard talks a lot and very beautifully about listening.
Mm.
And the best coaching I've ever done in 20 years has always been founded in presence and listening and connection and recognition of the wisdom and wholeness in the client. So in a funny way, nothing has changed. It's just that I understand why what used to work works.
Mm. Mm. That's very powerful what you just said. Because like I say, it's sometimes coaches or people helpers,
mm-hmm.
they impact people, don't they? And sometimes they don't even know why.
Exactly.
It's just something that has been heard by the client. And
exactly.
And it's good to know what it is that's happening on both sides, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It really is. It really is. And, you know, in the beginning, I thought I had a lot of expertise and that it was my checkered life experience and my personality that made me a good coach and my mind. I'm really smart, and that seemed really important. And one of the first breakthroughs I had as a coach was when I realized that it was better to have a client say, good question, than good idea.
Mm.
I used to love it when they said good idea, and then I saw, no, it's not my job to have the good ideas. It's my job to have the good questions.
Mm.
And you know, good questions I still think are lovely, but I'm less clear that they come from me. You know, it's like the good questions come out of the space between us. And my job's to get out of the way.
I loved that, what you said about the good questions don't come from me. Or I've mm-hmm. just got to get out of the way. Would you, and I think that points to the very core of the three principles, understanding. Would you like to talk a little more about that? About
sure.
Getting out of the way?
Yeah, getting out of the way is a really intriguing thing because it occurs to me that I don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
There's
I'm
some
already
days,
having this conversation, Molly.
There are some days when it's just like, will someone get her out of the way, please?
Yeah.
Oh, so I just really want to be transparent with folks that sometimes, and including sometimes when I'm coaching, it's just like everywhere I look, there I am. And at the same time, there's a way in which, let me just slow down here and see what's true in the moment. You know, I guess the paradox is that as a coach, when I find that I'm in the way, and this is also true when I wake up at 4 in the morning and I find that I'm in the way in my own thinking, not making a big deal out of that is the best way to get out of the way.
Mm.
It's like, I'm thinking earlier this week I was in a session and as you know, I've recently been diagnosed with breast cancer, and I recently made a big decision to have a bilateral mastectomy. Mm. And the day after that decision, I just was having a hard time getting out of the way.
Yeah.
And I had a coaching session, and I noticed that my energy, I was just kind of wound up, and it was something, for lack of a better word, very solid about me. But I just kept showing up. And it softened.
Hmm.
it softened. So I guess I kept listening to the best of my, at that time, it seemed like a limited ability. I just kept turning my attention to my client. And something showed up. Some question showed up or a story showed up. And pretty soon we were just off and we were doing our thing.
Hmm.
And the coaching started to take care of itself. And what I know in the past, a story occurs to me about a time I went skiing. And I had never been a skier. And in my 40s, I decided that it looked like a good idea to try it. Hmm. But I'm afraid of heights and I don't like slippery surfaces. I don't have any problem with it.
Yeah, so it's obviously the next step is try skiing.
Obviously. It made so much sense. And yeah. So I'm on the top of the bunny hill and skiing by myself. And my mom had been estranged from me for a number of years and had just re-entered my life. And I was experiencing this kind of psychological shakeup. And I was in a state of mind very similar to what I was in on Tuesday, just shaken up. And I thought, I can't ski in this state. And it occurred to me, I had read a book about called Inner Skiing, and they told a story about inviting skiers, new skiers, to pretend to be animals and chase each other down the hill like animals. And I thought, well, that's interesting, but nothing comes to mind, and I'm skiing alone. But what came to me was that I was Lauren Bacall. You love this. Right. And Humphrey Bogart was stuck on top of the mountain, injured. And I had to get to the bottom to get him medicine. And I'm not a skier, but I am a phenomenal athlete and a beautiful woman. I took him off down that hill, and I was amazing.
Mm.
And so I'm not exactly sure how that story has bearing, but it was like just allowing my state of mind to change and being curious about how could I do this? What could show up? And then accepting what showed up. And I think that's the key as coaches, and I have the fantasy that that's the key to what you do in these conversations, is that who knows if it's a good question?
Yeah.
But you accept what shows up. Who knows if it's a good idea?
Yeah.
So I don't know if that made any sense, but that's what I
thought. Yeah, it did. It did. I think it comes back to that, coming back to presence, listening, getting out of the way. And at first, we're so conditioned with, especially in the coaching world, they talk about having your toolbox.
Yes.
Not in the three principles world, but in the NLP world and the other. Like I say, I'm not well up on those modalities, but there's a lot of like, oh, what tool can I use here on the client?
Yes.
And like I say, this way, it's like throw all the tools out of the window and just meet the person.
Right.
Meet the person.
Right.
And
sometimes a tool will show up in your hand, and then it's like, oh, cool, a screwdriver. I guess I'll use it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, so it occurred to me on that hillside to do this thing that which you could call a tool. We could turn that into a tool, the Lauren Bacall tool.
Yeah.
But that would be to miss the point that the inspiration showed up without needing to reach into a toolbox.
Mm. Yeah. The tool just appeared in your hand that would be helpful in that moment.
Right.
And another day, it could have been totally different. You might not have needed a tool at all.
Exactly. And that was something else I went through as a three principles practitioner. I went through a phase where there was a no tools rule.
Yeah.
And I was very tool phobic. And then one day I found myself saying to a client, I wonder how it would be for you to just write down what you knew once a day. Wow. Well, I wasn't looking for a tool. It showed up in my hand, and she liked the idea, and it turned out to work for her, and that was the end of the no tools rule.
Mm.
But we don't have to cart around a toolbox and wonder what we should pull out of it. That's for darn sure.
Yeah. No, because wisdom will tell you what tool to use if you get quiet enough on it, if there are tools
in it. Yes, exactly.
I really like what you're saying there, Molly. Because like I said, there is a lot of people who initially they get this understanding. It's like, oh, if they've been coaching in other ways and then suddenly think, oh, I can't do that anymore. I've got to do it, like, just be totally
right
in the moment. And be totally in the moment, like you've just clearly said, sometimes an idea to use a tool, metaphor, may come up.
Right, because it's like there was a way in which, and this is embarrassing, but I was looking for a way out of life. I did not actually want to have a human experience. I wanted to have an elevated experience. And so when I, and there was also a way when I first really started to see the principles, I was just transported for a few weeks. I was in an elevated place and everything made sense all the time. And it was all beautiful and I was lovely and it was so cool. And then I kind of came back to earth. And I kept looking for a way back. I don't know. I'm getting off track. Something, let's just let that go. I don't feel like that's actually taking me anywhere except to confusion, but...
Okay. Well, that's good. That's wisdom saying it. Leave that alone.
Yep.
Well, maybe we could... Because I'm sure some people heard what you said before, and it was something I wanted to ask you about, because you've been quite open on Facebook with your recent health issues.
Right.
And you mentioned it earlier, so I think it might be an idea to talk about that, if you're okay with that.
I'd be fine with that.
And it appears to me from just the positive, and I'm not saying you've been doing this deliberately, I'm not saying you've been positive, but it seems to me your posts haven't changed much since prior to you discovering you had the breast cancer to what you're posting now. And you did just mention before about waking up at 4 in the morning with in your thinking. I think I can relate to that at the moment. Maybe I'll just share something with, see, I like to bring me into it, quite self-centered actually.
Yes, do.
my father passed away when he was 48. And I'm 47 now, so lately the mortality thing is suddenly seems to be, oh, well, I'm a similar age to my father when he passed away. So,
right.
And it seems to me the thinking I get into in my head about that seems to be, and it just reminded me when you said waking up at 4 in the morning and you're thinking, and it seems to be sometimes that there's this, like, almost this fear of the end of this human existence comes to mind, and then I can start piling more and more logs onto the thinking fire in many ways.
Right.
And now, luckily, because I've got an understanding of what we're talking about, I see when I'm doing it. Sometimes it might be 5 minutes, sometimes it might be 20 minutes down. I think, what am I doing? I keep pouring all these fearful thoughts about something that is going to happen one day, and it happens to everybody, but there's no point keep dwelling on it. So I'm just going with your health issues that you've had now. How have you found your understanding has been tested with, because it's, well, let's say if you're having a bilateral, what's it called? Sorry.
Mastectomy.
That's quite,
that's an understatement
to say. That's a big thing. It's a very big
thing. Yeah, it's a very big thing. Absolutely.
And you still have that tone where you seem upbeat. And so I'm just wondering if you'd like to, and because there's so many people suffer with cancer, and at some point many of us will, I think it's 1 in 3 get cancer, I think. So could you just talk to that, how it's affected you in the last few weeks or months?
It feels important to say that I've had some really low moments. The lowest was actually when I was sitting in the waiting room before the biopsy. I needed to get 3 locations in my breast biopsied, and it was I was wide awake. It wasn't, the procedure wasn't scary, but at that point I had no information other than some images. I'd seen X-ray and sonogram images, and it looked really nasty to me, which of course is all my thinking. So I'm sitting there, and it occurs to me that maybe I have stage 4 breast cancer and that I've wasted my life. And I start reflecting on how selfish I've been and how little good I've done and how much, I mean, just nasty.
How crap you've been.
And it occurred to me to then also beat myself up because I'm showing a very bad spiritual understanding to go there. And then it occurred to me, wait a minute. My spiritual understanding has nothing to do with controlling the human experience I'm having. It's been one of the most important things I've been grappling with over the last few years, is trying to unhook my ancient desire to control my experience or my understanding of where my experience is coming from. And it occurred to me, and my feeling is that this was wisdom, to let myself go for the ride. And as soon as I started to let myself go for the ride, something in me relaxed. And so 2 things were happening simultaneously. I was feeling really bad, but I stopped feeling bad about feeling bad. And when I stopped feeling bad about feeling bad, my experience became very kind of mutable and fluid and less solid. And it flowed and changed. And the next thing that was a real noticeable thing was I'm in the biopsy room, and the nurse is so incredibly kind that I almost start to cry. And I think, that's cool. And I'm also thinking, I've still wasted my life, but this is so beautiful. And I'm thinking, she hasn't wasted her life. She is so compassionate. I should have been a mammography technician. A friend pointed out to me later, I would have really sucked up. So the beautiful thing to me about all of that is that it was just an experience, and I had it, and then it was over. And I can't honestly say exactly when it was over, but I know that it was over before I even got the results that said I don't have stage 4 breast cancer. I have stage 2 breast cancer, which is a significantly less big deal. But that I want people to understand that this isn't about not ever having a low mood. And that there's a way in which understanding where my moods are coming from and also embracing the whole ride is what allows me to have the whole ride. And something else came in that moment of acceptance. It occurred to me, and again, I think this is wisdom, that I was doing the best I could. I was having a really super dramatic, self-involved, nasty little fantasy, and I was doing the best I could. And there was a sort of compassion that came in with that, which was kind of funny because at the same time I'm criticizing myself for not having a compassionate bone in my body. But what I hope I'm communicating is that the point of the principles is not to take us out of the human experience. But it, for me, I love that I could have that experience, and I love that I didn't have to make a career out of having that experience. That when my mood shifted, I didn't have to do what I've done in the past in my life, and that's go, well, I'm happy now, but the truth is that I have cancer. And, you know, I can just let all of the experience unfold. And it appears that doing that, I tend to have a lot of good experiences. So I've had, I think, since this started about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I had one really bad morning before the biopsy, if it makes sense to label it a bad morning, but I had a hard time. I had, I forget exactly which night it was, but I had one very wakeful night of worry. And I had a tough day Tuesday this week, second guessing my choice about the mastectomy. And I think that's pretty amazing that I can actually count on, you know, a thumb and one finger, basically. There haven't been very many hours of struggle and low mood, but they've been there. And I hope when I write and talk about it, that people feel the permission to have the whole human experience. I choose not to write from the midst of a low mood because it doesn't strike me as helpful. It doesn't seem to be helpful to me to get on there and say, I'm so scared. I'm afraid I'm making the wrong decision. For one thing, I thought about doing that on Tuesday. I'm afraid I'm making the wrong decision. And I realized I was going into my personal thinking and that writing from there would be an analysis of the decision and an analysis of the principles that work behind the human experience. And that I'd just be all in my head. And I thought, I might end up sounding really smart, but it's not going to be particularly real. And I don't know that it will help anyone. And certainly don't know that it'll help me. So I write for people and I write for myself when I'm settled down. And I choose to think when I'm settled down. I mean, I have lots of thoughts happening when I'm wound up, but I don't think about it a lot, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it just came to mind then of what I said earlier about when you're wound up and you're in a low mood, it makes no sense to carry on adding more fuel to the fire with more low mood thoughts. It's just counterproductive, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if I have a sleepless night, I used to worry about sleep. If I have a sleepless night, I don't worry about it. I understand that it's temporary. I sometimes have the fantasy that I wish it would go away. Sometimes I don't. But I don't worry about being anxious. I don't see anxiety as a permanent state anymore or as a threat.
Yeah.
And because of that in itself, I think it tends to move a lot faster. As soon as I have an anxiety problem or an insomnia problem, oh, man.
Yeah.
That stuff can last.
Well, can I ask you, because obviously I didn't know you before you came across the principles, but I just get the feeling that you was probably quite a positive person anyway. How would you say that gaining an understanding of the principles has helped you through this I was going to say crisis, I don't know if that's the right word, life situation at the moment?
Right. Well, you know, I think in a way I've been quite a positive person. I've also been prone to anxiety and depression all my life. And the big change that the principles have given me is I don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah.
It may happen, it may not happen, and it's nothing to worry about. And that has made a profound difference in my life moment to moment. It's not just that I know it will pass, which I do, but that there's not a way I am that is a problem. I mean, what a relief. I also, all my life, and I expect this is true, I think it's true for most people, if not everyone, you reflect on your life and you see that there were moments when you just knew what to do. And it's not because things turned out right later. That's not what proves it. What proves it was that quality of knowing.
Yeah.
And the principles And there was something that I heard Sid say and caught from one of his videos. I just felt pointed toward that quality of knowing. And I went, okay, no more messing around. That's what you count on. And to me, there's just a way in which that confidence in being guided by wisdom, the confidence in being guided by what I know when I know it, has deepened. And that's actually how I came out of the day on Tuesday where I was feeling stuck about the mastectomy. I realized I was looking for the right answer. Is this the right choice? And there was also a bit of what will people think? There's a lot of politics and positions around mastectomy. And I think it was actually popped out. I'm not sure how it popped out at me, but what came to me was, I don't know what's right, but I know what I want. I don't even know why I want it. I've got a rationale, but I really know I want it. Oh, cool. There's something I actually know, and there's a quality to that knowing that I really trust. And it has nothing to do with whether or not it's the right decision medically. I mean, who knows what makes this the right decision? It could be how this conversation affects someone who listens to this program. It could be some random research result 30 years down the road. Yeah. It could be some, I mean, it just actually doesn't matter. No. But there's something in the quality of that knowing that matters, I think. It matters that we respond. I'm making this up in the moment, but what comes to me is that when we feel that knowing and resonate with it and honor it, it's as if we're helping wisdom and life become fuller and more alive for everyone. That's my fantasy.
I'm really liking where you're coming from, Molly. And I can totally relate to that knowing aspect. There's been, well, I'd like to think there's more than a couple of moments when I've known what to do in my 47 years. But there's been some that have been really like almost as if I've been smacked across the face with like I've suddenly known what to do in life situations. It's been almost surprising the clarity of the knowing that's come up for me. And I can imagine there's some people now who are in situations where they just don't know what the hell to do. They don't know. They don't know what to do. So, I'm sure there's people maybe in similar situations to you now with health issues, or there's any limitless number of issues that people get caught up on and they don't know what to do. And I can imagine there's some people. How do I get to that place where I know? How do I get to that place?
Yes.
So, what would you say to those people?
Wow. First of all, I'd say, do I get it? There are some places in my life where I just do not know.
You and me both.
Yeah. What I know about not knowing is that debate doesn't get me there any faster. So a couple of things occur to me, and this is just this is how I see it from where I sit now. It's okay not to know. And that if you don't know, that's what you know. For now. And if we take getting it right, usually when I don't know, one of two things is going on. I'm thinking I need to know something that I just don't know yet. It's not time for whatever reason. Or I'm like on Tuesday, I'm looking for the right answer. And that takes me into my personal thinking and my second guessing and my debating society, and that's not where wisdom lives. And so if it can be okay not to know, if there's actually no this may sound really absurd, but it's like there's no consequence that matters to not knowing.
No. And sometimes decisions, even if you don't know, the situation they were in might call for a decision to be made, mm-hmm. for example. And then you've just got to hope for the best, I suppose. I mean, if you don't know, you think, well, if it's a crossroads, it's like left and right. And if you take the wrong one, you don't know. You have to take one of them.
Exactly. I see that as, you know, life's a creative enterprise. And as an artist, I know that when I was making a piece, I would frequently come to a juncture where I'd go, this is either going to be fabulous or one of the ugliest freaking things on the planet. And you just make a choice and you're kind of flying blind.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, this is not a test. You're not going to get penalized for getting it wrong. And we can interpret life that way. So right now, one of the things I don't know is what to do in my business. And it seems like I haven't known for a very long time. And it seems to me to be a financial strain.
Hmm.
But that's just going to play out the way it plays out. There's no actual rule about how much money I'm supposed to have in the bank.
Yeah.
And there's no actual, for sure, guarantee that I'm going to feel good when I have that amount of money instead of owing this amount of money. Because I know people who are in the reverse financial circumstances who are miserable.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
So I think, you know, we make up the game of life, and I don't understand why or know why, but we participate in creating life as we go. So I think it's valuable to take action and to do things and to make things and to create. But it's valuable because it's life-affirming and it's creating-affirming. It's not valuable because you get it right.
No. And some of the I can look back at my life, and some of the greatest learning I've gained is from getting things wrong.
Yes, me too.
Because I think I've made the wrong decision or this or whatever and gone in the wrong direction, whatever area you want to call it. And afterwards, there's been so much learning from that
right.
I've been able to help others. If I've been talking to others or friends, I think, I've just told them about. And everybody's got it. In some ways, you've all got a... I heard Eckhart Tolle once talking about children, and somebody said to him, oh, wouldn't it be lovely if we could help our children not make any mistakes? And he said, no, that'd be terrible. So that's how people grow. And, I think we're so obsessed with getting everything right all the time. Whereas some of our greatest learning and life experience comes from the lows as well as the highs, isn't it? If it was everything was up, was getting everything right all the time, it'd be boring, wouldn't it?
It actually would be. It'd be very uniform.
Yeah.
And like I said, there was a strong streak in me that I didn't really realize that for a long time, but I was looking for a way out of the lows. But it occurred to me once that when we're in a hard spot, it's like being in chapter 6 of your story. If the hero in the book doesn't get into big trouble by chapter 6, it's going to be a very boring book.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever heard it put like that before, but yeah, that's sort of true.
So you've got to get in trouble.
Yeah.
You've got to get in trouble. And just don't stop at chapter 6. You know? And there are a bazillion different ways that being in trouble can play out. You know, I could turn out to be the world's happiest bag lady. or, you know, I might end up to be the world's richest woman. It's, who knows?
Yeah.
So it's not a passive thing. I think we stay engaged. When we don't know, you give it your best shot. you make it up. And I think that we mostly get stuck because, not because we don't know, but because we're thinking there's something right that we're supposed to know.
Yeah. And sometimes, this just occurred to me, Molly, well, most people know I'm a gardener. And to me, it's when you're getting into that place where you need to know and you should know. And I think you're pointing to it, sometimes we just don't. It's like trying to force a seed to grow before it's ready to. It just won't.
Yeah.
It won't. If something's not ready to sprout, it just doesn't matter how much you feed it, or obviously there's some scientific things you can do nowadays, but generally speaking, there's just, if a seed's not ready to sprout, it won't sprout.
And you know, I live in Washington State, in the Western Washington, and there are years when you just don't get tomatoes. Hmm. And this year, I ate one yesterday. I've never seen a tomato in June. Never seen a tomato before the end of July.
Right.
And many years, we never get tomatoes. And so to judge my gardening based on that would be really goofy, or to stop gardening because of that.
And isn't that what many people do, isn't it? They have a few things going wrong in their lives, and then people that say, oh, sod it, I'm giving up, and they more or less just then seem to sit in their chair, and they don't try things because, oh, everything goes wrong. You get
right.
That's very sad, isn't it? Because like I said, someone getting things wrong can be some of the greatest learning we mentioned before.
Absolutely. You know, I'm thinking of kids who make up games, you know, and when I was a kid and we would make up games for hours, there was no such thing as getting a game right.
Yeah.
You know? How do you play cowboys and Indians right?
Yeah.
How do you play princesses right? You just make it up.
Hmm.
And it's scary. There are days when I find the idea that we're making it up almost paralyzing. But when I really look at it, that's because I still think there's a right way to make it up.
Hmm.
I'm forgetting that this is a sandbox, and I do know how to play in a sandbox. If I knew how to do it at 6, I certainly know how to do it now, if I let myself access that.
Hmm. So would you say that's how you go through life now, in a very it sounds to me that you go through life in a playful way in some ways, just... is what I was reading between the lines you were talking.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. I don't think that's actually true.
All right. It was me trying to be poetic then with the words you was using.
Yeah. What I'm talking about is how I think about it when I'm stuck, and I'm stuck a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And so what I would say is that there are times when I relax and access that six-year-old and just play in the sandbox. Definitely there are times when I do, but I don't want people to think that that's like what I live from.
Right.
I would love to say that, but that wouldn't be honest. The thing is, more and more, the reason I love conversations like these, and the reason I love my work, is that the more I have conversations like these, the more I really realize and have that embodied feeling of like, oh yeah, this is how it works.
Hmm.
And that's more helpful to me than just like passively watching videos and things. I think for people to actually be in conversation, oh, I know what it is. There's a little bit of a paradox. What's been most helpful to me about being playful and living in a more creative way has been dropping my pose of being spiritual and getting it, and dropping into more of a, really? So for a while I was like, okay, mind's got my back. The energy of life is supporting me. I don't need to worry about my business. I was like trying to believe that. And then one day it occurred to me that is that really true? And I started to engage in looking to see if it were true instead of trying to believe it was true. And my experience really shifted dramatically. So there's a paradoxical way in which sometimes even doubt can take us to a greater place of insight than trying to adopt a playful attitude or a positive attitude.
Right. Can I ask you about that? Because you said you
sure.
had to see if it was true.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you find?
Well, what happened is after about 2 days, I just had this, I had a sensory experience, and it was almost like the visual and somatic experience I had was like my foot was touching sand on the bottom of the ocean.
Right.
And I thought, oh, yeah, there's something there.
Hmm.
And I just, it was just a feeling. And I found that feeling much more supportive and reliable than my mental belief about it.
Mm.
And so I feel like I really learned something important about allowing, and what occurs to me in this moment is allowing our whole human experience, including the lows and the doubts and the worries, if we don't push that away, there's a way in which that is what leads us to wholeness.
Hmm. Hmm. Yeah, it's not labeling the things as they arise in life, is it? It's when we begin to label things good or bad or ugly, or it's all just life, isn't it? If we can
exactly.
Hmm. But we're just so conditioned with all constantly being bombarded with messages of what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad.
Mm-hmm.
And when we just let go of all that and just, like, what I'm hearing you is just drop into a peaceful space, but it's when you let go of all your judgments of stuff, that's what's found.
Exactly. What happens is that we drop into a peaceful place, but we get there by not trying to do that.
Yeah.
and letting go of our ideals about it.
Yeah.
I keep going back to that. You know, I now regard that biopsy morning as one of my most precious experiences. Because I've had a long ongoing conversation with myself about me not being compassionate enough by my standards.
Mm.
And the woman who was sitting in that waiting room was so sad about her life for a few minutes. And I honestly don't know if it went on 3 minutes or 10 minutes or what. It wasn't very long, but it was very poignant.
Mm.
And by allowing myself to fully experience that, this doorway of compassion and understanding opened for myself, the last place I was looking for it.
Hmm.
And I got that hit about doing our best, which also was very humbling because I clearly had an idea that my best looked quite different.
Hmm.
And it was just the most beautiful coming home. And I got there through an experience that I was inclined to judge as really far below my spiritual standards.
Yeah. Hmm. You never know when something's going to come up, do you? To wake you up or another insight.
Yeah, and it really occurs to me that that line, it's all good.
Yeah.
Wow, it's all good.
You know, it's so interesting you said that, Molly, because only last night I was, I quite often enjoy sitting quietly now. I'm turning to a right old hippie. it really did occur to me that all life is just pointing us towards what we're pointing towards now, what we're talking mm-hmm. about now. It's like the good, the bad. I know it can be, when we look at it from an intellectual perspective, it can be quite a challenging statement, but it seems to me, from my limited understanding, that all life is just pointing us back to who we really are.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't always come in nice flavours, or what we'd call nice flavours, the pointings that we get, or the nudges we get.
Right. Mm. Right, and it occurs to me that it doesn't come in nice flavours, because if it did, it would be suggesting that there's a way we're supposed to be.
Mm.
And it's like we just get this shown us over and over again that no, love looks like this and this and this. Wow.
Mm. Well, I'm so pleased, Daria, invited you, Molly, because I've loved this conversation, and the time's going by really quickly, and I know you've got somewhere else to be, so I won't keep you much longer. But, and perhaps we could do this again. Like I said, the hour's gone by so quickly. Perhaps we can have another chat sometime down the road.
I think that would be grand.
Mm. So do you have any particular kind of people you work with? I know some people have the niches or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you working with mainly at the moment, Molly?
I am mainly working with anyone who wants to work with me.
So that's your niche, anyone?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good
In
niche.
Fact, it reminds I me, like my, it. My first niche as a life coach years ago was people who think Molly Gordon rocks.
Well, I think you rock.
Good. Yeah. So, and it's funny because I taught and coached marketing for years, and
right.
I preached niche, and I am nicheless.
Nicheless. The freedom of being nicheless.
The freedom, a woman without a niche.
Might be a webinar there in that title.
There might be, exactly.
So if anybody, like I said, I know if anybody wants to get in touch with you, wants to work with you, or mm-hmm. got any questions to ask, because like I say, you've been very open about your health issues, and maybe there's some people who are going through similar things. Would you be open to speaking to those kind of people as well?
I certainly would.
Right.
I certainly would. And it actually even occurred to me that I may, in August or September, do a group around breast cancer or health or body image. So,
yeah.
So I'm just kind of letting that inspiration sit and see where it goes.
Right.
And the my company name is called Shaboom, S as in Sam, H A B as in boy, O O M as in Molly, and my website is Shaboom Inc. You just add INC, short for incorporated, .com. So people can find me there or search for me on Facebook.
And you've got quite a lot of videos out there now where you've been interviewed and stuff, haven't you? I know there's quite a lot of good interviews you've been in.
Yes. There's quite a lot on YouTube. I think it's called Shaboom on YouTube, too, if people want to search for that. A number of 3P conversations and some longer hour-long conversations and a whole heap of 2 to 4 minute videos.
Lovely. Well, Molly, it's been great speaking to you, and I kind of feel like I could speak to you. I've quite often said this to my guests, and it's true. I could go on and on speaking, but I really would like to speak to you again sometime.
I would love that, Mark.
Okay.
And I'll follow up with you too, because I'd love for you to be a guest on one of my hangouts.
Oh, lovely. Cool. Yeah, I'd love that too. So, well, thanks, Molly, for your time.
Yeah.
And if anybody wants to get in touch with me, they can get in touch with me at icecreamforthesoul@hotmail.com. I must mention the Viva event that we've got coming up here in Spain in November, where there's people from all over the world coming to speak and coming to be part of the gathering. It's going to be a fun event. Helping people, in many ways, get a grasp of what Molly and I have been talking about, especially we're hoping to get more and more people who've not come across this understanding yet, because there's lots and lots of people in the Alpine, people helping world who are already getting this understanding, but we want to get more in. So if you know of anybody who's a people helper and you've been impacted by this or impacted by stuff that's going on, please mention the Viva event to them. So anyway, I'll let Molly get off and I'll get off as well. Thanks so much, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon, Molly.
Excellent. Thank you, Mark.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
If you just stay on the air after I've finished speaking to you on here.
Sure.
One sec. Thank you. Bye, everybody. Bye.